Rabbit Hole, your favorite Bitcoin podcast.
But I don't want to go among mad people.
Oh, you can't help that. Most everyone's mad here.
What's up, everyone? It's your boy Kaz. I'm here to tell you about Swan Bitcoin. Swan Bitcoin is the best way right now to buy Bitcoin. They allow you to dollar cost average into it on a daily, weekly, or monthly basis, and then withdraw to cold storage, self-custody those keys. Don't wait for the perfect time to buy Bitcoin, because the perfect time to buy Bitcoin was yesterday. Start dollar cost averaging with Swan and start sacking some sats. Go to swanbitcoin.com/Kaz. You'll get $10 worth of Bitcoin when you sign up. Hope you enjoy this episode of Down the Rabbit Hole. What's up, guys? So I'm here with Nadav and Ben. They both work at SureBits. How are you guys today, gentlemen?
Doing well.
Doing awesome.
Yeah, so we're going to get deep into it today on the tech side, talking about discrete log contracts, oracles, Lightning Network, pretty much anything is fair game. So let's just start at what you guys do. So you guys both are engineers at SureBits. What is SureBits?
SureBits is a startup. You know, we're at this point just a few engineers, and we've been working for quite a few years on kind of all things related to Lightning and other kind of cutting edge Bitcoin tech. We maintain Bitcoin S, which is a Scala library for Bitcoin, and kind of off of that we build bunch of stuff. I've been working a lot on discrete log contracts, and Ben's also been working on that quite a bit. We're working right now on trying to hack around with Eclair to do some custom stuff on the Lightning Network. And I guess we also have been working a lot with kind of market data around cryptocurrency exchanges and seeing if there are ways of using Lightning in cool ways to sell that data, you know, using the kind of the micropayment infrastructure that Lightning has, and also like a bunch of other random stuff that we do. I should have been anything to add.
Yeah, I think you hit most of the points. I didn't join till like late 2019, so you guys had already fleshed out all the market data stuff, but since I've joined, we've just been primarily working on DLCs and Bitcoin S, and made a lot of progress, so I think that's like our highlight nowadays.
Yeah. Cool. And then we also have a blog that y'all should feel free to check out. We try to post pretty long posts weekly about kind of all things Bitcoin development and new things and Lightning, Taproot, Schnorr, all that stuff, DLCs.
Yeah, I love the blog posts. You guys are you're putting out very informative content. I like it. It's hard for people on the outside to grasp all the technical sort of improvements that are coming to Bitcoin. So I saw the Scala library. What was the thinking behind Scala? Like what was the design sort of consideration for why Scala?
Neither me nor Ben were there when this decision was made, but I actually joined SureBits in large part because of kind of my functional programming background. So I can still speak to this, I hope. So Scala is a strongly typed language. It's both object-oriented and functional, whatever that means. But essentially, the type system gives you a bunch of assurances about kind of code correctness. And so it helps us avoid a ton of foot guns, and also kind of helps with testing and development and things like that. So especially with kind of infrastructure that's, you know, caring for people's Bitcoin and their, you know, money, valuable things, you have to make sure that you're not, you know, accidentally burning everyone's money. And so, you know, we've got like different types for all the different things, and you know, there you kind of just get assurances that certain kinds of mistakes just aren't allowed to happen in that kind of system. And it has other benefits too, but we don't need to get into, you know, the programming language debates.
Yeah. This is another small point is that Scala is like built on the Java virtual machine. So like anyone that uses Java can use their Scala library, which like a lot of older institutions use like Java in their backend. So
totally.
It'll be like an easier library to port in than if they wanted to put it in like Rust Bitcoin, then they might need bindings and stuff like that, versus this is a lot easier, just add a dependency and move on.
That makes sense, sort of like looking at it from an enterprise standpoint.
Totally.
Well, cool. So let's start from the top. So discrete log contracts. I know Nadav, didn't you study your math as well, right?
Yeah.
So let's maybe start at what is the discrete log problem?
Sure.
It relates to Bitcoin.
Yeah. The discrete log problem is the hard problem underlying the cryptography that Bitcoin uses. So essentially in a public key crypto system, there needs to be some kind of one-way function with a trapdoor. So tearing that apart, we have essentially some kind of process which is not reversible. So you have private keys and you have public keys. If you have a private key, which is just some number, you can compute a public key from that really easily. But if someone has a public key, they shouldn't be able to compute the private key. And so unless they have some like extra information. So you have like some kind of hard problem. That kind of is what you use to do encryption and digital signatures and all that kind of stuff. So in Bitcoin, we use the discrete log problem on an elliptic curve. It's not too important to know what that is, but if you are interested, there's good content out there about this. I'm going to write like a super brief thing that's coming out on Tuesday. It's like a explain like I'm five Schnorr digital signatures post, but I also link out to a bunch of pretty in-depth resources. It's going to be pretty hard with just audio to try and explain what an elliptic curve is and that,
right.
That kind of stuff. But yeah, kind of at a high level, the discrete log problem is just the idea that if you take a point on an elliptic curve and you add it to itself like 5 million times, and then I give that resulting point to someone else, they won't be able to figure out that the number I used was 5 million. And so 5 million would be like my private key in that instance, and my public key would be the point on the elliptic curve. And all of the cryptography that Bitcoin uses, I guess other than hash functions, kind of assumes that that is a hard problem to solve computationally.
Thank you for that. So I wanted to just touch on that point from a nomenclature standpoint. So obviously it's not super relevant, you know, to understand the math behind the discrete log problem, but it's like, why is it called discrete log contracts?
Yes. So yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead. Okay. Anybody.
Cool.
Yeah.
So essentially the contract is, just uses this problem to kind of enforce a condition. So what you do is you have a public key or a point on an elliptic curve, which you can compute from public information from an oracle. So you have some oracle which is going to be broadcasting a digital signature of an event. So say they're going to broadcast a digital signature saying whether or not the Bitcoin price is going to be over 10K by the end of next week or something like this. And they've committed to doing this. They've told you what the messages that they might sign look like. Then just from the Oracle's public keys and from the message that they said that they might sign. So for each of the possible messages, let's say yes and no, or over and under, you can compute a point on an elliptic curve, which is going to be its pre-image will be the digital signature. So you don't know anything about the signature that the Oracle is going to put out, but just from public key information, you can compute kind of the like analog public key information about the signature. So the signature is just a number and you can compute its point. And so if you use that point in your Bitcoin kind of setup, you know, you tweak some stuff using this public key, then this stuff will only kind of be unlocked if you learn the private key. And again, a discrete log of a public key is a private key, is why it's called the discrete log problem. So essentially, it's a Bitcoin contract or, you know, contract on really any platform, which is essentially locked using a discrete log and is unlocked by learning a discrete log and revealing it.
Cool. So, Ben, I know you put out a demo in the past couple of weeks, I believe, about, you know, betting on the election. It seems like sort of one of the main use cases around discrete log contracts right now is betting. So what are some other use cases that could come in the future?
Yeah, in my opinion, betting is going to be like probably the most major use case, at least in the beginning, just because, I mean, just the Bitcoin and in general crypto space is filled with degen gamblers, it seems. So there's always a use case there. But like in the future, there's definitely like, it'll probably be like real institutional use cases where people can start like hedging like real world things that go on in like, you know, $1 million assets, or like maybe doing like synthetic assets, or I don't know, just being able to have like a prediction market will lead to like lots of like actual market use cases that like we see in the traditional world just moved onto Bitcoin with like a more, instead of having to do like an escrow contract, you instead can like actually have custody of your funds in a real bet, which is a huge upgrade.
Yeah, and I think you kind of alluded to this, but also just kind of like more generally non-custodial Bitcoin-backed derivatives would be a good example of, you know, I guess you could call it gambling if you wanted, but I'm sure some traders would be offended. Yeah.
So, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say it's also kind of just a nice building block for, I guess, other contracting schemes, where you kind of have this, you could think of it as like a new primitive of like an oracle lock. You know, we have hash locks, time locks, and, you know, this is essentially using something like a point lock or something to enforce, you know, a contract to be contingent on an oracle signature of some event or something like this.
Yeah, so what exactly is a point lock? So this is PTLC. I know you've referred to this in the past. Is this like something that's already happening on Lightning, or is this something that would come sort of with oracles and DLCs?
So it's not already happening on Lightning. It hopefully will come, you know, even before all this other stuff. So PTLCs are a lot like HTLCs. So for those who don't know, HTLC stands for hash time lock contract. It's essentially a payment, say from Alice to Bob, where Alice says Bob can claim these funds by revealing a pre-image to a hash, where the hash, you know, goes on the output. And then after a certain time lock, Alice can claim those funds back if Bob doesn't claim them. So this is kind of the primitive contract used to do routing over the Lightning Network. It also has some uses elsewhere for coin swaps and other things like that. And so a very similar version to this is called PTLCs, which is point time lock contracts, which is exactly the same, except for rather than revealing the pre-image to a hash, you reveal the discrete log to a point, or the private key to a public key, essentially. And so they function in much the same way. Point locks and hash locks are both just ways of, you know, making things atomic and doing some other stuff like that. But kind of the benefit of using point locks is that points have way more information and structure to them than hashes do. So, you know, hashes just kind of destroy information, and you can't do very much with them without, you know, using heavy zero knowledge proofs or something crazy that people tend to want to avoid, super complex. And so instead, with points, you can do all sorts of stuff, including, for example, DLCs. So I would say, you know, DLCs utilize point locks in order to function. So they kind of pick certain points which correspond to Oracle signatures, and then use point locks. So I guess there's kind of, you know, two different related things being developed, both at Shredbits and elsewhere right now, relating to kind of implementing point locks and, you know, trying to get those on Lightning because they're just better than HTLCs in every way. And then there's also kind of the specific use case of point locks more generally, which is discrete log contracts, which is also super cool.
Just to add a note there, like with point lock contracts, like the really nice thing is like you can do math with these points. So then like when you have multiple routes or multiple hops and a payment going on, you could like use that math to like add applications on top of it, or just to make things nicer and more private. Because like with the current HTLCs, like if you're doing a payment across Lightning Network that has like maybe five hops between, it's going to be the same like hash preamage throughout the entire route. So like these people, if they talk to each other, they can see that they're in the same payment. Versus once we have a PTLC, we can like change the point around it between that and then just have it end up being the correct thing at the end of the route. So that way they can't know, like just looking at the same point, that they're getting the, like they're in the same payment. So you're getting like a privacy benefit there, as well as like now that it's point, we can also do the math. So like we can make that point for like our DLC. So then the Lightning payment becomes a contingent on our contract, or, you know, we could, I don't know, there's some other use case where you can find something where you're, if you're revealing a point that becomes part of your contract, and then it becomes like contingent on your payment as well, which there's like tons of cool use cases you could do there.
Yeah. Whole blog series on PTLCs for those interested over on the SherdBits website.
Yeah, so let's double click into that. Like, what are some of the use cases that would come in the future? Obviously, I love the privacy benefit. Mm. And so, like, what else can you build? Like, Nadav, you use the term information and structure that are sort of around PTLCs versus HTLCs. It's like, what can you really build on top of that?
Yeah, so kind of as Ben mentioned, one of the, I think, primary motivators for why we definitely want to replace HTLCs is payment correlation. So payment points allow us to decorrelate payments between hops. So, you know, if Alice is paying, Zachary through Bob and Carol and Dave and, you know, a bunch of other people, you can't have 26 hops, but, you know, you get the idea. So then you have this issue where every single hop along that route uses the same payment hash, because it's quite difficult to trustlessly tweak hashes along the route. But with points, it's super trivial. You just, you know, add a random nonce and tell everybody what their random tweak is through, you know, the onion that's being passed around that no one else can see except for the person who needs to know. And so essentially what you get is every single payment along the route uses a different point that looks entirely random and unrelated to all the others. And so people along a route on a Lightning payment, first of all, there's the privacy benefit of, they don't know that they're kind of helping route the same payment. They can't kind of do all the same network analysis that they can right now, at least not as easily. And then on top of that, it avoids these things called wormhole attacks, where say, someone at the front of my route and someone at the back of my route are, you know, talking to each other or are the same person running multiple nodes or something like this. They can actually collude to steal the fees of every routing node in between by just revealing the pre-image once it gets revealed from one end to the other and skipping everyone in the middle. And that is not great. And it's also not detectable by any individual node on the network. So it's not great that we can do those things right now with HTLC. So that's kind of the primary motivator. But wormhole attacks aside, you also get a bunch of kind of these cool applications you can do on top of PTLCs. So these include, there's so many. AMPs, for example, atomic multipath payments. Right now we have MPPs, which are multipath payments on Lightning, where you can essentially say, I want to pay Ben one Bitcoin, but I don't have one Bitcoin lying around in any channel, but I have like three channels with a third of a Bitcoin each. I can kind of send him multiple payments all at once. So the version of this on Lightning right now, well, first of all, it's even worse with respect to payment correlation because all of these three payments have the same hash. And, you know, so that's not great. and you know, even more chance for wormhole attacks. But then on top of that, it's also not as nice a construction as it could be, because Ben could claim some of the payments before others have shown up, which, you know, I've seen arguments that this isn't really a big deal, but, you know, we don't need to have that. So with discrete log-based atomic multipath payments, you have a bunch of payments where, you know, all of your different payments use different points at every hop along the thing, so it just looks like a bunch of payments. And the person who's getting paid can't claim any of their payments without first without first getting all of these individual subpayments set up. So everything has to reach them before they can claim anything. So that's nice. There's also, you know, kind of like what we've been talking about, you can make Lightning payments contingent on Oracle signatures. You can make Lightning payments contingent really on any Schnorr signature that you want, including like you can trustlessly pay someone for a specific signature of a message. So that has a bunch of use cases, including paying discrete log contract oracles, we think. You can create payments that are contingent on kind of these, you know, any combination of ands and ors. So you could picture like, you know, a multi-sig of like people who have to sign off on a payment for it to go through. And if any like three of five of them say like, yeah, this can go through, then the payment does, otherwise it doesn't. You could think of this as kind of like an escrow contract. You can do all sorts of escrow threshold contracts on Lightning using PTLCs. And I guess the main benefit of PTLCs is that all these different things that you can do, and I haven't even listed all of them look indistinguishable from just normal Lightning payments. Like Ben gives me an invoice and I pay him, just like we do on Lightning today. You wouldn't be able to really tell the difference.
Yeah, right. So we're moving the contracts, like, or quote unquote, like if we do have a contract for like for this payment where like we're doing this like multi-sig thing, or it's based on a, like an Oracle signature, that's all basically just happening like off chain in part of a signature, and then all of it will just get settled down into like one signature on chain that'll look like any other signature. So like it's very scalable. Yeah, exactly. So it's like very scalable, and you know.
Yeah, Andy Polster has called these things scriptless scripts. So yes, it's like executing scripts, but without using any scripts.
Yeah, which is very nice, because like with other systems, like I don't know, like any altcoin, like their entire script needs to happen, like, or their entire contract has to happen on chain, and like everyone needs to verify that. But
yeah,
ideally, like I don't care what Nadav is, you know, paying for Starbucks. I just care that he's not changing the money supply. So like that's all we need to verify. And then his contract is what he's going to worry about, make sure that goes correctly. But he'll enforce that himself. And then I just need to enforce that he's, you know, not inflating the money supply or breaking any other like core tenets of Bitcoin.
Yeah, or in the case of Lightning payments, not stealing from you in particular.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think that's an interesting point to touch on. It's like some of the other quote unquote like smart contract platforms, whatever you want to call them, like their entire contracts are on chain, which leads to a scalability problem, and it opens the surface area for like an attack as well. So if you like, if you can see all of the like the way the smart contract's using certain functions and all of that, you know, you can also potentially find a way to break it and, you know, steal people's money. So I think it's important to touch on that, you know, DLCs are happening like off chain. And all like you can see that's happening on chain is like indistinguishable from like another a multi-sig, right?
Yeah, and once we get Taproot, it'll just be indistinguishable from a normal payment,
right?
Single
right.
person sending.
So Bitcoin. Let's dive into Taproot.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
this is the it's everybody's Twitter name now. This is just Taproot 2020. So is it gonna happen in 2020?
I don't know. So.
I don't think so either.
Can it, please?
I mean, technically it could, but like going by Bitcoin Core's release schedule, the next release won't be probably until like end of this year, and so that won't be enough time to activate, even if it was in that. So
I'd love
probably not. Yeah, I mean, I'm down if it does, but it'll probably be out. I'm guessing it's activated like by like April next year or something, but we'll see.
Looking forward to implementing it in Bitcoin S.
Oh yeah.
So let's break it down. What's Taproot?
Oh boy. So it's like three things and some other things. Ben, pick your favorite and you can do that, and then I'll do one.
All right, I'll do TapScript. So okay. Bitcoin's scripting language has some not really problems, but there's some nice to have that we could change about it. So one thing is like upgradability, where like right now we have these things called opnops, which is basically like just a useless, like it's a function that does nothing. That's,
you call them opnops? I call them opnops.
Oh, I always call it opnop.
I could be wrong, but go on.
But what these do is basically like they're just reserved for like future soft forks. So like these have been used for like OpsCLTV, OpsCSV, stuff like that. And
which are time locks for those who don't know.
Yeah, but the problem with these is since they do nothing, they can't have like any side effects. So like if you wanted to add a new signature schema, you couldn't really use this because you can only do like, if you want to do like an op check sig, that after it completes, it'll leave a true or a false onto the stack for your Bitcoin script. But since these have no side effects, it can't do that. So what TapScript does is replaces all these with op success. So that way it's a lot easier to soft fork any changes. So then like if you put in one of these, so like if we were to soft fork and change one of these things from op success to like a new script code or like the new function, it'll just like read op success and automatically go to true. So then when we go to soft fork in a new like function, we would just change that to be, you know, true for when it is valid and false when it's not. So that way it's a lot easier to upgrade and we can have any side effects we want with this. Mm-hmm. And then there's those other like small changes, like changing op check sig to use schnorr instead of ECS.
Small changes. Come on, that's one of the big three I was mentioning.
Well, I mean, in regards to TapScript, that's like a small change, I guess. And then op check multi sig is changed to op check sig add, something like that, which is just, it's op check multi sig, but slightly different. And I think that's like, that's all that is, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's also like the sig hash change for TapScript, I think. That's very good. Where the default thing that you sign when you're signing a transaction contains more information.
Yeah. So now the signatures commit to the other inputs, script pub keys and output amounts. So what that means is basically they try to do this with SegWit, but sadly they didn't do this commitment to those other inputs. So right now there's like a recently, maybe earlier this year, there's like a BIP 143 vulnerability disclosed where you could accidentally overpay on fees if you signed twice for an input. And like for someone could like reuse a signature from two transactions. But now this is fixed more or less, because now since your signature will commit to all the other inputs in this transaction, that means if anyone changes their input in the transaction, then your signature would no longer be valid. So
And additionally, for multi-party protocols like DLCs and like Lightning in the future, once we have dual-funded Lightning channels, currently with SegWit, it's quite... there's a bunch of overhead that's needed in order to stay safe if you're not a full node. So if you want to be, say, like a neutrino node or a pruned node or something like this, you have to keep around extra transaction data. Otherwise, it's not actually secure to sign things when you're signing things with other people, because they could lie to you about, you know, their funding inputs and stuff like this and lock up all of your funds. So all of this stuff is going to also simplify DLCs just in that way alone.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and also I would love to emphasize schnorr signatures are awesome and way better than what we use right now in all the ways. And so TapScript also does that.
Yeah, definitely. I talked about this with Gigi
like the Snore Signature upgrade should have happened, I feel like, a long time ago. So is what you guys are working on with DLCs, it's using ECDSA right now, right?
It's using both. So on-chain, it's just ECDSA because, you know, it works on-chain today. But off-chain stuff does use Schnorr. So oracles, when they sign things, those are Schnorr signatures because they don't need to be validated by, you know, the Bitcoin network or anything. It's all off-chain data, so to speak. And so, that stuff we are using properties of Schnorr signatures in order to make DLCs work. But on-chain, we are still using ECDSA right now. Though, you know, of course, everything will be nicer when we move to Schnorr.
When do you think that'll be, like, activated? January
with Taproot.
With Taproot?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
it has to be with Taproot.
Yeah.
Well, that's the current plan.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's one of the three things that Taproot involves. And then I'll pick out another one. So another one is called MAST, or Merkleized Abstract Syntax Trees. Or I guess in the BIP it's called Merkle branches. Mm-hmm. But any way you call it, it's a Merkle tree, which is just a hash, but it's actually a tree of hashes. So you take like some large set of data and you like pair up all the data down at the bottom, and then you hash those things together, and then you hash the hashes together in pairs going all the way up until you only have one hash left. And then that's the actual commitment to all of your data. And then you can prove to someone that you committed to some specific piece of data by revealing to them kind of a branch going down this tree with each of the hashes that are next to the hash on this branch. And so then they can verify themselves without knowing any of the other data that's committed to, just that one specific piece of data has been committed to. So in the case of Merkle branches, what this means is that on chain, rather than putting like a script hash, which is literally like a hash of a Bitcoin script, you instead put a Merkle root, which is also a hash on chain. And then if you want to spend that script, you reveal a specific spending condition that you want to use without revealing anything else about your contract. So essentially, it's a contract where you don't show someone like, here's my giant, large, you know, Bitcoin contract and all the things that could have happened. And instead, you just show them like, here's the spending condition I'm actually going to use. And normally, because of Schnorr, this is just going to be like a single pub key spend or a single pub key spend with a time lock or something like this. And so that will improve, you know, privacy, fungibility, all the things you get from having a larger anonymity set, as well as, you know, saves on-chain fees when you're trying to use big contracts and all sorts of other cool improvements. You can split up multi-sig into a bunch of, so say you have like a 2 of 3 multi-sig, you can split that into a Merkle tree, which has 3 different branches, or 3 different leaves, 3 different spending conditions, where say if it was 2 of 3 with Alice, Bob, and Carol, you have the Alice, Bob spending condition, the Alice, Carol spending condition, and the Bob, Carol spending condition. And with Schnorr, all N of N multi-sig, so if everyone needs to sign, you can always condense that down into a single public key and a single signature. So it just looks like here's a branch and here's a single signature because we committed to this spending condition. So you can kind of just hide everything and make everything look the same. So that's MAST. And then Ben, do you want to tap tweak?
Yeah, sure. So like today with a Bitcoin like output, what you have is like you kind of have two options where you're going to have like, at least in Segwit, you're gonna have pay to witness, pub key hash, or pay to script hash, or one of them is just, you know, like a single sig transaction for pay to witness, pub key hash. And the pay to script hash is like what you use if you actually have like a script that you want to use, not just paying to a single public key. But what Taproot does is kind of just combines them both into one, where now you'll just be paying to what looks like a public key. And so how we do that is you have an inner key, and then plus your script hash, like the Merkle root. And what you do is so if you wanted to just pay just to the public key, you would make that Merkle root, just like random data. And then your inner key would be tweaked by the Merkle root. And then that is now your like your public key. And then when you go to spend, you would just, you know, tweak your private key by that Merkle root. And then if you want to like spend from the script hash, you then just reveal like your script and the Merkle proof for like part of that script and just spend from there. So this is really nice because like when you're paying to the output, you don't know if it's going to be a public key spend or a like a script hash spend, which is nice. So now everything will look a lot more same, like completely the same. And this has like really nice privacy benefits for like coin joins and stuff like that, and other things where, you know, having the same looking outputs just is nice all around. As well as now, you give like kind of people more optionality where, you know, if I have a spending condition, that's like the nice version where we all just cooperate. We don't need to always need to reveal our script to do this. We could just use the key pass spend if we do all agree, and then don't need to reveal any extra information. But, you know, if we do have a disagreement, then we'll, you know, go do the Merkleize path and just do it, the proof for that, reveal the script, and go on from there. And, you know, you're now saving room still because you're using the Merkleize path, not having the real, your entire script.
Yeah, and just to, you know, make it super clear, in Taproot, all Taproot outputs on-chain that have not been spent, so all UTXOs that are Taproot UTXOs, look exactly like they look indistinguishable. It doesn't matter whether it's a complex contract or multiple people or one person, they all look exactly the same until they're spent. And then even when they're spent, they all look pretty similar when you're spending.
So yeah. With Taproot, you could essentially have, you know, a DLC that's, you know, being signed by an Oracle with a 3 of 5 multi-sig, and that's indistinguishable from, you know, just a normal payment right now.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just trying to make sense of all of it. There's a lot of moving pieces.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So I guess to touch on that point, so Taproot as an upgrade proposal kind of has these three different pieces to it, and, you know, various miscellaneous upgrades like, you know, versioning and changing the sig hash and stuff like that. But so the reasoning behind kind of doing all three of these in one big upgrade instead of doing them kind of individually, there are a couple of reasons. One of them is that it'll probably be easier to, well, the theory is that, you know, people won't want to constantly be upgrading their Bitcoin nodes to get all this new functionality. And so we'll end up in a state where, you know, this is the point I know less, so maybe I'll let Ben talk about it. But the other point is that there are huge privacy gains to doing all of them at the same time. Like if you did just Schnorr, but without Merkleized abstract syntax trees and without tap tweak and stuff like this, you would still end up with kind of multiple anonymity sets. It would still be an improvement, but you wouldn't get this like giant dramatic improvement where all things look the same. Except for a couple, you know, if you're having disagreements, then things can look like one of three ways or something like this, at least in most cases. So kind of the benefit of doing all of these at once is that they kind of interoperate in really nice ways that let us kind of make everything look the same and more private and fungible and that kind of thing. And then there's also this kind of, I think, more minor point in the BIP that I botched trying to explain of like, it probably turns out to be more complicated to activate if we try and do like a bunch of smaller changes for this kind of thing. That said, Taproot as an upgrade proposal does a really great job of sticking to just kind of these three things and known things that need to be fixed, and doesn't really introduce a bunch of other stuff that people also want to do with Taproot and hopefully will be included in future softworks.
Yeah, to touch on the upgrader, like, the hard part of like doing all of them separately, like if we know, like say we did these like each individually, like first Schnorr, then Taproot, then TapScript, like that would be really annoying for like a wallet dev, because, you know, if I know like if Schnorr comes out today, but I know like a year from now we might have like Taproot, and then a year from now we might have TapScript, it's like it's kind of disheartening to implement it, and then it's gonna have to redo it again. Or like redo like everything again to have to implement Taproot and redo it again to have to do TapScript. So like you're gonna get like bifurcation on the network where people are like on different parts of it using different things, And it's a lot nicer to be able to like roll them all into one, and like you just have like one upgrade you need to do, and then like on the Dob said, now we'll all share the privacy. It benefits of that in the same like similar anonymity set versus like bifurcating that and having like three subsets, and you know, it's not ideal, and it just makes it easier for us developers, I think.
Right, it's kind of what's happening with some other platforms right now with the bifurcation in their networks. You never want that. But okay, so bringing it back to DLCs, so what does the incentive structure look like? And you know, like I have so many questions, I'm trying to distill them in the right way. So yeah, let's start with the incentive structure for like maybe somebody who's running an Oracle.
Yeah.
There's like a big sort of debate going on in all of the cryptocurrency space about like having decentralized oracles versus centralized oracles.
Totally.
And you guys have sort of taken the model of a centralized oracle, mm-hmm. but you found the way to like align the incentives that you can trust a centralized actor in this sort of way.
Or that you should be more willing to at the very least.
Right.
Yeah, so I guess in case anyone is confused about what a decentralized oracle is, it's not like a single entity. It's usually like a bunch of people who, via some mechanism, usually involving like staking or something like this, eventually reach some kind of consensus where like the people who won the battle for what is true like steal the money from the people who lost that battle. And I guess, you know, the common criticisms for these kinds of schemes is they're gameable. You know, if you're rich, you kind of have unequal sway over what is true according to the blockchain or according to the Oracle and things like this. So I guess we, or discrete law contracts, kind of take this different approach where, rather than trying to, you know, trust is necessary in schemes where you're trying to do something on chain that requires data be input from the real world. There's just no way to do this trustlessly. Someone has to, or something has to, tell you what happened in the real world, or even, you know, in some other part of the internet, or, you know, that's what by real world I mean something quite broad. But so essentially some trust is needed. I think that so oftentimes when people are talking about the Oracle problem, I guess there are two ways of talking about it. One is like thinking of a solution where you don't need an Oracle anymore. I think those are quite rare, just because, you know, it's a fact of how blockchains are built that, you know, you need Oracles if you want to do interesting things to do with the real world or data from the real world. And so I like to think of the Oracle problem more as like, what is the correct like incentive structure and trust mitigation that you can put into place so that you can feel better about trusting things. Because at the end of the day, you need to use some trust. So you want to minimize it, and you want to put it into trustworthy actors. So that being said, the decentralized approach kind of like spreads out your trust amongst a bunch of random people who could all be the same. You never know. Because, you know, it's like pseudo anonymity. You know, it's just a public key or something like this. So you have those kinds of schemes. We prefer in DLC land to kind of have this notion of an oblivious oracle. So you have oracles, which are just like centralized entities. You could think like, you know, Blockstream could run an oracle, Bitfinex could run an oracle, Shredbits could run an oracle. And so you have these just like centralized entities that are broadcasting digital signatures of things. But kind of one of the key properties is that they do not know how they are being used. So all, like literally all that this Oracle entity does is it just broadcasts signatures of things. And even if it looks on chain and tries to do chain analysis, it will not be able to discover that it is being used or how it is being used. Or like if it's signing a price, like what kinds of derivative contracts people are entering into using that price feed or anything like that. So they're just like completely oblivious to all of that, even if they look on chain. And all they're doing is broadcasting signatures. And if you're using something like Lightning, you can kind of anonymously pay them for their signatures if you want to add this kind of extra incentive of, you know, if an Oracle is being paid, it has like reason to exist and continue, playing well, playing nicely. And then on top of this, there are mitigations against things like equivocation. If an oracle signs multiple messages for the same event, so they say two different things happened, then they leak their private keys, their signing keys. And so, and you can make this detectable on chain by having them like put some funds into those keys and having those funds be like burnt if someone is able to derive their key because they equivocated. And that would be just kind of a signal to everyone that, hey, this oracle isn't trustworthy. Everyone knows their private key kind of thing. There are a couple other things. So these oracles are nicely composable. They snore signatures. And so you can have, when you're making a contract, you, first of all, as a user, get to choose your oracle. You're not bound to a specific oracle just because you want to do a certain kind of thing. So long as an oracle is signing for an event, you can use that oracle. And you can use multiple oracles, and you get to choose kind of your, like, federation, so to speak, as opposed to, like, something like a side chain where, you're stuck with the federation that's enforcing the side chain. In this scheme, you have oblivious actors, and you get to choose which ones you want, and you can use multiple. And so the idea is that, if any one of them lies and everyone's using multiple oracles, that doesn't actually benefit the oracle in any way because it doesn't sway any of the contracts because everyone is using multiple oracles. But everyone sees that they lie and they go out of business. So it's kind of this nice model of, it's if you want to do bribery, you have to bribe a lot of entities whose entire business models are based on like trust of, their oracle and their brand. So that's kind of the solution to the oracle problem that DLCs present at a high level. Anything I missed, Ben?
I just kind of thought of this, but technically, you also, if you wanted a decentralized oracle, you could make like disaggregate all those together and make that like your one oracle. But we're not losing that functionality. It's just it's going to complicate like the actual logic for them to do that. But it's possible. So like, if you really want to do that, you could.
Yeah, so you could have like your weird Ethereum staked oracle, and so long as it emits a Schnorr signature at the end of the day, then I suppose you could use that to enforce discrete log contracts.
Okay, so I'm curious. I know that there's a way that you can basically, if the oracle is behaving in like a sort of a dishonest way. So let's take this up and like make it sort of an example for people. So if we take the example of the, creating an oracle on betting who's going to win the election. So you have Trump and Biden. Isn't there a way that like if you, let's say you have an oracle that's a part of, 50 different DLCs and it's signing for all of those, and one of those, let's say Trump wins the election and it signs that Biden won out of 50, and then it signs all the other correctly. Isn't there a way that you can basically steal the funds from that oracle?
Go ahead, Ben.
Just to clarify, so like when the oracle is doing this signing, they're not going to sign for every single contract. They're going to do one single signature for this event, so they'll sign like one message saying Trump won, and that'll be useful for any contract using this oracle. So that signature could be used for one contract, it could be used for a billion contracts. The oracle will have no idea. So the only thing they could do is just publish, like if they wanted to sign for Biden and Trump, they just have to publish two of them and just hope no one finds both of them and can steal their private key. But more than likely someone will find those two signatures and be able to steal their private key. So I
think though that there is at least some concern around this in at least the current state of DLCs. We don't have kind of decentralized gossip of Oracle signatures implemented or anything like this. The first iteration is going to probably be more like, REST API based or something like this, where people make anonymous requests to the Oracle and just get responses. So in this kind of world, while the Oracle still doesn't know how much it's being used for various reasons, for example, one person could buy the signature or get a signature and then just like tweet it out, or, you know, all of these things are super, like, you don't need to get it from the Oracle. It's a signature. You can validate that it came from the Oracle. And so the idea is that, you know, if an Oracle decided to respond with one of the two signatures, you know, all but once, and then the wrong or the other signature, the one time, then so long as anyone in the world, you know, presumably some of these are being posted, and the signature is being posted in a place where people can see, who sees two signatures. So for example, the person who was wronged here, the person who was given the wrong signature, they are probably going to be the most likely person in this particular example to find the other signature, compute the Oracle's private key, and then, as we mentioned, the Oracle should be staking funds on their signing keys on chain, just like on a pay to pub key address. And so then once you know the private key there, those funds are spendable. So that's the idea there.
So what does the monetization aspect look like for Oracles? Like, can anybody theoretically just, you know, start running an Oracle, and like, what's the overhead look like? You're essentially just like, you know, signing, right? So I'm assuming it's going to be pretty easy to get one up and running. And like, why would somebody want to run one? Like, is it going to be like individuals, or is it going to be like mainly like companies, you know, Blockstream, SharedBits?
The overhead to running an Oracle is like basically zero. Like, you need to publish like a public key, and then a public key for each event, and then a signature at the end. So at most, it's like, it's under like 150 bytes per event, which is like non-trivial, like, or that is trivial. So you can like easily run that through Tor extremely privately. And, you know, I mean, you just need like an internet connection to be able to do that. And then,
and a data stream.
Yeah, I guess a data stream to be able to verify or like send out the correct things. But otherwise, running an Oracle is going to be extremely easy. So it could be, you know, it could be like you or me, it could be, you know, Blockstream, it could be the US government, whoever. We expect early on it'll just be, you know, like random like Bitcoin and crypto exchanges, like, you know, maybe like Bitfinex or Coinbase, whoever, because these players are already doing Oracle stuff for like others, like Ethereum and like all those guys. So for like
Uniswap. It makes a lot of sense for exchanges to be publishing this kind of Oracle stuff even for free, because their monetization isn't from the Oracle itself. It's from matchmaking and collecting fees off of matchmaking. And so they kind of, the existence of the Oracle helps them benefit in other ways. They kind of make money on the back end in most schemes that we expect to come up early on, at least.
Free advertising for them.
Yeah, free advertising, and also just like, you know, it helps things run smoothly on their end. And I think that there are other kind of examples of businesses that will end up being Oracles for this reason, where they're kind of making money on the back end. But then just from monetizing Oracles themselves, I think it's, you know, totally feasible. And, you know, you could receive payments for commitments to events over Lightning and things like this. But I do think that since this is kind of an ecosystem surrounding trust and reputation, we likely aren't going to end up with like a huge set of randos. because, you know, if you're choosing your set of oracles, I don't know that it would be too profitable to be like an unknown entity. Though I expect there will be at least some, and, you know, people can, you know, as Ben mentioned, data concerns aside, the overhead of actually just being a signing Oracle isn't that high, especially if you're doing it like, you know, manually or something. You don't even need to worry about data streams so much. It's just like, yeah. But I don't know. I think that there's some interesting, it'll be interesting to see how the ecosystem for Oracles develops, but it's a lot of speculation at this point.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair on like the rando doing it, like, at the end of the day, an Oracle is just kind of like a public key. So like, you have like, you like, your Oracle is just putting reputation behind that public key. So like, a rando could do it. And, you know, if they're consistent and like a good actor and like, you know, doing events that people want, theoretically you could become like a big Oracle by just being a rando with a public key and signing stuff. It's just, people have to put trust in that. So like, maybe
someone wants to do Coinbase because they maybe they could sue them or something if they did the wrong thing, or because, you know, they have a lot more money, so they might want to put more money behind that public key. But I mean, otherwise, you know, a rando could do it and build reputation under that public key and just be just fine.
Yeah, I hope all you cypherpunks heard that in the future, brands will be public keys.
Exactly.
You heard it from Ben first.
Okay, so we've touched on a lot of different things. I want to go back to sort of like the TAP script, Bitcoin scripting. Like, how does it differ from other platforms, and like, what were the design? Like, I have some friends, you know, they're not fully red pilled yet. I'm working on it, but they still, you know, they're into the shit coins and they're like, oh, like smart contracts, blah, 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 blah. They really don't understand it enough to even know what they're talking about. So what are like sort of the design considerations around, you know, not having a Turing complete scripting language on Bitcoin, and, you know, like, what is that going to look like moving into the future?
We kind of touched on this earlier, but like the idea that like, or like originally Satoshi designed it, like just be like a minimal scripting language. So, you know, you could do like basic scripts without having like things that run infinitely. Cause like what a Turing complete language is means it can do like unbounded computation, which obviously you don't really want in a Bitcoin script. Cause if I could just put like something that runs forever in my script, well, now that block will take forever to verify. So you don't want that. So you need a way to stop like execution. So like the easiest way is just not allow that, which is what Satoshi obviously did. But and now like we've kind of come to the realization, like we kind of touched on this before, that, you know, I really don't care what your contract is. I just want to verify the monetary properties of your transaction to make sure you're not like breaking the rules that I set, which is, you know, don't inflate the money supply and don't, you know, double spend or whatever. So now we kind of move to things like we're talking about, like scriptless scripts and stuff like that, where your contract logic is kind of moving off chain into these like cryptographic primitives of like, you know, adding together like sig points and stuff like that to create like signatures. And then the actual like script execution is just going to be like super basic, you know, like check verifying signatures. So that just makes it like a lot more private, because now your thing isn't on chain and you're not revealing your script logic or your contract logic, as well as, you know, it's more scalable because you're not putting all these span conditions on chain. You're just producing signatures, which are a lot smaller.
Yeah. And I think, so if you want to be using, you know, your blockchain for, you know, cool applications, and you also want to like use it as like private money, those things don't really work well together if you're kind of, you know, revealing a ton of information in all of your contracts for your like kind of application use cases. So some kind of more obvious examples of this are like, you don't want to reveal your trading habits to everyone in the world if you're a trader. Like, normally traders are quite secretive about their strategies and, you know, their executions and things like this, because they're worried about front running and all sorts of other things. And so it, when you're kind of like using, for example, you know, an Oracle, like an Oracle structure, I mean, I don't know many Oracle structures, but I assume, you know, something like Chainlink, you leave an on-chain footprint every time you call an Oracle. And it's not hard for people to tell, you know, what it is you're doing just by looking on chain. So it's kind of even worse than, you know, a lot of Bitcoiners will say, like, you don't want your neighbors to know how much you spend on groceries. Well, in this case, it's like, you don't want everyone in the world to know, like, every button you clicked on an application all the time. You're kind of leaking a ton of information by doing everything on chain. And on top of that, it's not scalable because, you know, everything that happens on chain, well, first of all, there are fees to be paid, and there's, you know, a fee market, and only so much can fit in a block. And so you hit throughput. You know, blockchains are super inefficient databases. You can't just use them as a replacement for kind of these, you know, off-chain databases. And so, you know, the idea, at least, you know, we speculate, and I'm sure some people actually know, the idea behind using kind of a dumbed down contracting language on Bitcoin is you don't want to use Bitcoin as a computer because blockchains are terrible computers. You want to use Bitcoin as a ledger. It's a ledger and maybe some time stamping stuff, but you know, you want to keep it to kind of those concerns. And then you can build on top of that. You can build all your applications, but you know, we don't think it makes a lot of sense to use complicated scripts on chain or for that to even, be a thing. And we have in kind of the Bitcoin ecosystem developed, out of necessity, ways of doing a lot of these kinds of things without having any fancy scripts. You know, the invention of scriptless scripts came out of the Mimblewimble project, where literally the only thing you have on chain is like a Schnorr digital signature. Like that's what you get to put on chain. And so the question is like, what kinds of contracts can you enforce using just digital signatures? And it turns out a lot. You can do a lot with just digital signatures. You don't need scripts, and it kind of turns out to be the right way of doing things. And I will say though that because it doesn't take a lot to do, you can do all of these things elsewhere, right? It's not like when I call it a Bitcoin contract, really I mean Bitcoin compatible. Like it's simple enough on-chain footprint that it can work on Bitcoin. But if it's simple enough that it can work on Bitcoin, it can work elsewhere. It's just kind of like, out of necessity, we've discovered all the right ways of doing things that are private and scalable and all these other kind of concerns. And I would be very surprised if in, the shitcoins of a decade from now aren't using, discrete log contracts and all the rest.
Yeah, I mean, that's the beauty of open source. You can copy whatever anyone else is doing. So, I mean, have at it, but I mean,
Bitcoin's yeah, and like here, so. DLC oracles aren't like chain dependent. They're completely agnostic. You could use the same oracle on-chain Bitcoin, Lightning, Ethereum, and Tron all at the same time.
Yeah, but then you have to trust the other platforms, which is
why. If you're using them, that's correct.
Yeah, right, exactly. So what does it look like, looking forward into the future again with DLCs? Like, is this going to be like an integration into wallets? Like, is it going to, how user-friendly is it going to be for the average person to set one up in the future?
Today, at least our implementation is not the prettiest. You're like copying and pasting JSON between each other to set it up. But
in our defense, it is built into the wallet, though.
Yeah, it is built in the wallet, and like automatically select your funds and set it up and broadcast the transactions for you. But I think like it'll be like similar to Lightning UX, at least where you do like, you click open. Like right now with Lightning, you like find your buddy, you click open channel with this, you instead like hit like open contract, type in your contract information and the oracles, and then the wallet handle everything from there, do the communication between the two wallets to set it up. And then on execution, you'd probably just, press execute and then paste in an oracle signature. So it'll probably be pretty easy UX by then, similar to Lightning where, you just click open and then click close it when you're done.
Yeah, or similar to like an exchange right now. If you're trading on an exchange, it should look relatively similar. You're opening a position, you tell them what your position is, you hit the button, it happens. Hmm. And also, this, I don't think that this is too far from now. Like I know over at the Atomic Loans people have an app called Atomic Finance that is quite a slick GUI that hides most of the DLC stuff and uses DLCs in the background. It's still in like beta testing right now, so it's going to be out in a couple of weeks, they tell me, though, so I hope that they're cool with me shilling them here. But yeah, I think that it'll definitely, the UX is improving rapidly, kind of as the specification becomes more stable, and yeah, I think you can expect some pretty slick graphical user interfaces pretty soon.
Yeah, I mean, we like technically we could have a slick UX now. It's just
we don't have front end developers.
Yeah, and we're also like more so waiting on the spec to be fleshed out before we implement like the peer to peer communication. Because we could like just implement like whatever we do now into like peer to peer, but It's going to change like according to the spec, so we want to get that like at least somewhat finalized, and then so we can start implementing it and not have like big changes to do later.
Yeah, and DLCs are being specified with, you know, kind of the future in mind. Not things won't be manual in the future. We have like standards for serialization of Oracle information and all that kind of stuff in the works.
Yeah, which will be very nice once it's ready.
So you guys are working on the standards as well at SureBits?
Yep. Yeah, so there's I think it's github.com/discrete-log-contract/DLC-specs. If you just Google any part of that or, you know, something like that, I'm sure you'll find it. But there's a work in progress kind of Bolt-ish. So similar to the Lightning specification, we're trying to mimic all of their kind of format and stuff like that, because we think it specifies things rather nicely. And we're also reusing a bunch of other stuff from Lightning specification-wise. But yeah, we're writing a bunch of specifications. Right now, there's actually quite a bit done. Transactions are specified. The peer-to-peer messages, unencrypted, are specified. There's an open PR with like, I think it's like 1,000-line PR that adds like static test vectors for people who want to, you know, get started on all this kind of stuff implementation-wise. We've got like 3 or 4 work-in-progress implementations, Bitcoin S being one of them. Yeah, and we have like, you know, monthly spec meetings that I usually tend to lead, including developers from SureBits, CryptoGarage, and a bunch of other kind of independent developers. Lloyd, who's a Square Crypto grant recipient, and Antoine, who I forget what his affiliations are right now, but
he got a grant from someone, I forget.
Yeah, he was at Chaincode, and now he's some other things. So yeah, we've got a bunch of developers, and Nicolas Dorier, a bunch of other people all working together to kind of come up with a common specification for clients and oracles for discrete log contracts. And you know, someday we'll add Lightning and all those other things, but for now that stuff is more kind of implementation proof of concept kind of stuff. But yeah, there's a cool spec movement. It's all open source. If you're interested, want to contribute, want to give feedback, open issues, open PRs, come join us.
Yeah, Nadav is tired of writing it all.
I'm tired of writing all the specs. Yeah, I want to write code, guys. Yeah, no, but yeah, it's we're nearing some cool first stage of specification, I would say, where things are starting to get more and more stable, and we're almost at a point where like we have multiple different independently written and evolving discrete log contract implementations, which will be able to kind of interop with each other. And you know, someone can use a Bitcoin S wallet and, you know, NDLC, which is like a BTC pay server compatible implementation, and like open a contract with each other.
Yeah. And we're also doing specification for the Echo oracles as well. So we'd like it so if I want to, you know, bet on the election and or be an oracle for like the election, that like what I'm signing is the same as like what someone else would sign. So it's a lot easier for like the wallets to implement as well. It just saves everyone time. So there's lots of stuff going on there, which is exciting.
Yeah. I'm trying to avoid all the foot guns.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's dive into the synthetic assets conversation. Nadav, I know you sent me a little bit about this yesterday. I guess just take it from the top, like what is a synthetic asset? And like, how is that going to work with like Lightning, and you know, what would these look like?
Yeah. So first of all, I don't have a finance background. So if you do, I'm sorry for butchering this, but to my understanding, a synthetic asset is kind of when you, so say like synthetic USD could be where you actually are holding Bitcoin, but you have some mechanism by which you can safely denominate it in USD. And like, you know, if the price of Bitcoin goes up with respect to USD, then like some of your Bitcoin will go away and you'll have just a fixed USD amount. So, you know, traditionally this could be achieved pretty easily custodially, right? You like give your funds to Abra, for example, they do this. And then, you know, you can withdraw later and it'll be Bitcoin, but it'll be like the same USD amount of Bitcoin as you deposited. And it's also, you know, usually these synthetic assets, one of their goals is to be liquid. And so essentially you have something that, you know, value speaking acts like USD, and, you know, on your wallet, you can even have it like be the UX, look like you're essentially holding synthetic USD, and you can send it to people who are accepting Bitcoin, or, you know, people with Bitcoin can send you Bitcoin that will turn on your wallet to look like it's synthetic USD. So essentially that's the idea. And with discrete log contracts and the Lightning Network, there is kind of a implicit, I don't think anyone's actually written like a detailed up-to-date proposal for this, but a bunch of people know how this is going to work using DLCs in the Lightning Network, where essentially someone who wants to say hold synthetic USD on the Lightning Network so that they can have a Lightning node and, you know, pay for things on Lightning and so on and so forth. But to them, the user experience, it looks like they have some other asset that isn't Bitcoin. And to be clear, it doesn't have to be something sensible like USD. It could be, I always like to make the joke, it could be Patriot points. It could be like, well, some index to do with like how the New England Patriots are doing in the NFL season that year. And then you just track that index like relative to Bitcoin in some way. Like, you know, just... You track a number is all you need. So, you know, if the number is the BTC USD price feed, you get something that looks like synthetic USD. But you can really use this for, you know, any irresponsible thing you want to. Not that you should, but you can. And how it works is, say you wanted to hold synthetic USD. How this would work is you open a channel with another party. And then, you know, both parties have some funds in this Lightning channel. And, you know, it's just a normal Lightning channel. You can pay over Lightning to other people using funds from this channel by routing. But in this channel, what's happening is, say, every like 10 seconds or every some short time interval, you check how the price moved since the last interval. And then, say, if the price of Bitcoin went up relative to USD, then the person who's holding synthetic USD pays a little micropayment to the other person. So you can picture like an abacus, and you're like moving funds back and forth based on how the price is moving, so that one side of the channel is always a fixed USD amount. And so you can do this by having the two parties trust each other that they'll pay each other every 10 seconds. That's one way of doing this. You know, in theory, it should be small amounts at any time interval. So, you know, you should do this, but, you know, still not ideal. And what if you want, you know, slightly larger time interval or something like this, or the price is super volatile, or the index you're following is super volatile, and, you know, suddenly it jumped and they have to pay you a bunch and they just refuse to. So rather than doing this, kind of the next idea in the progression that leads us to DLCs is you could have one party be trusted. They could be like Bitfinex or something. And then you could have the party which is not trusting the other one, so Bitfinex in this case, could hold some collateral. Like, they could custody some collateral from the other party so that if the other party doesn't cooperate, they can just take that collateral. Otherwise, they get it back at the end when they want to close the channel. You know, you have kind of semi-trust or one-way trust in a channel like this. But then with DLCs, we kind of reach the nice trustless version where you don't require counterparty trust. And instead, what you do is you put a DLC on your Lightning channel. So, you know, a Lightning channel, in some sense, has these commitment transactions, which is these off-chain commitments that you're kind of just updating and revoking. And you have the newest commitment, kind of, so to speak. And then when you want to close the channel, you don't need cooperation from the other party. You can just broadcast this commitment transaction because everyone signed it. So you add a DLC to your commitment transaction. And this particular DLC, a lot of people call them contracts for difference, or CFD. That's like, I think, an actual finance term. So that's why they call it that. It's not just a random reason. But with these CFDs that you put just as an output on your commitment transaction, what you get is you, rather than having one party custody the other party's funds, you have a discrete log contract custody both parties' funds. So both parties put something like the maximum amount that they might have to pay over a given interval in any reasonable fluctuation. And then what the DLC does is it enforces who gets how much of that kind of pot of money based on what the price is. And then assuming that, you know, this is a normal case and parties are cooperating and they want to keep this channel up and running, then at every interval, you know, they don't actually use the discrete log contract. They just, you know, pay one person, pays the other one in the normal cooperative off-chain way. And then they update and put a new discrete log contract for the new time interval with new funds in it. So really how this works is you could picture it as, you know, if you want this abacus picture where you have beads and they're moving back and forth between the two sides. Now you kind of have this DLC in the middle and both parties have some beads in that DLC. And then when one party pays the other one because the price moved against them, what they actually do is they, the party that is gaining funds takes some from the pot in the middle and the other party adds some to the pot in the middle. So you kind of have this like middleman, but the middleman is not an entity. It's a discrete log contract, which is, you know, just a non-custodial, trustless solution to this problem. And then, yeah, that's kind of the mechanism by which you can get synthetic assets on the Lightning Network. So you could have a wallet that makes it look like, say, you have USD or any other thing you wanted, but you're still able to interact with other people who are just using Lightning normally, you know, with Bitcoin.
Ben, is there anything you want to add to that?
I think you did a pretty good job. Like, so you could do this with any asset, which is nice. So, well, out of this, then you could maybe build like some sort of DEX if you somehow wanted to, but that might be better for like RGB or something.
Yeah. So let's.
Is that a segue, I smell?
That's a great segue. So I asked you guys both this question. I know you guys are not the RGB experts, so. No one's gonna hold you to it, but like, let's explain a little bit about like what it is and like, is there sort of any like interaction between like DLCs and oracles and RGB and like sort of bringing, like smart contracts, quote unquote, to Bitcoin?
Totally.
I'll go first. So, like with the DLC question, they 100% are usable with DLCs. We've actually talked with the RGB team a couple times. It's like getting like preliminary stuff out to see like how could we support it, but they definitely can, because like we talked earlier, like DLCs are just signatures at the end of the day, so like they can be used with any crypto system, so RGB is one of those. But what they basically are is being able to hold a token on Bitcoin or on Lightning. So like, I don't know, if you wanted to do like CryptoKitties or just having like Tether is the obvious example, where if you want to hold Tether on like Bitcoin, like today, you can't really do that. Normally it's like delegated to like an ERC-20 token or like putting it on Tron or something like that. So do this on Bitcoin. We use RGB, which uses like these things called single-use seals and some other things where like the Tether server kind of has like a record. And since you're going to be trusting them for the actual end of the day funds, it's kind of okay to trust them with like having this like internal ledger, and then use these single use seals to transfer it between parties. And then when you want to settle that, you just take your proof that you got it sent from you back to the Tether server, and they'll update it. So instead of like having this long proof of all the transfers that happened, they just update the server like, oh, now you hold it. So then you're like no longer trusting that like someone between your like since the last settlement with the server like screws something up. That's my understanding of it.
Yeah, so I'm gonna preface my understanding of it by saying, you know, I could be wrong. I don't know that this is true, but at a super high level, my understanding is that RGB consists of these magical cryptographic commitments that you use where you like tweak public keys in certain RGB ways so that people who are following the RGB protocol and know your actual public key can like verify that like the tweak you used indeed committed to like this thing which proves that you own this tether or something like that. And then there are kind of these proofs of transfer of ownership that you can use. I think there are different versions for on-chain and for Lightning. I think on-chain uses the fact that like your UTXO gets spent and the people who actually, you know, holds the RGB asset is the person who holds the corresponding output on-chain that's unspent. So you look at the UTXO set or something like that. And then on Lightning, I think it gets more complicated and you have like proofs of ownership chains and all sorts of other stuff. But at the end of the day, my high level understanding is that you use some kind of cryptographic commitment scheme that people can verify if they're given some extra information. So it's hidden on chain. So it, my understanding is it does look like normal, if a bit weird and cheap. You know, you won't spend a bunch of Bitcoin to make these things happen. It'll be just a couple sats, but you have some like Bitcoin activity, but then in the public keys and in the cryptographic stuff, like signatures, and maybe they use op return, I forget, but you use some commitments and those commitments enforce kind of a system of proving that you own an asset or that this person used to own an asset and here's a proof they transferred it to this person and here's a proof that person transferred it to me and so on and so forth. And eventually, you know, you can go back to like Tether, the issuer, and be like, hey, look, here's my proof that I own these coins. I'd like to claim them now or something like this. But then putting these on Bitcoin lets you kind of interoperate with a bunch of stuff, including DLCs. So, you know, you can have a discrete log contract so long as both people support RGB, where like one person is putting in Bitcoin collateral and the other one's putting Tether collateral. And, you know, you output like some kind of mixture of those two things, or, you know, both people input Tether and you're just doing a non-custodial derivatives contract that's Tether backed instead of Bitcoin backed, or, you know, the analogs of these things on the Lightning network. There's all sorts of mixing and matching, but that's my high level understanding of how RGB functions. Sorry, Maxime, if I butchered it.
I'll have to reach out to their team and see if I can get them on a show, because I'm curious, you know, all about RGB and like what it looks like in the future. But so, do you guys think they're going to be like other tokens outside of Tether that are sort of launched on the top of this?
I'm sure there'll be other stable coins like, you know, USDC and all those, but otherwise, I don't know. I mean, Bitcoiners are pretty resilient to shit coins.
Exactly.
But Ben, what about wrapped Bitcoin on Bitcoin?
But I don't know. I mean, maybe we'll get. I mean, like talking to like some people from like the Lightning Labs team, they're kind of saying, you know, like Lightning's like the fastest way to transfer things. So I could very well see, like,
I mean, traders want to trade.
Yeah, so, like, traders might want, you know, wrapped Ethereum or something on Lightning, and if, like, exchanges support that, they could, you know, deposit funds faster maybe and get some, like, better arbitrage opportunities. So we could get, which would be pretty funny, getting, like, wrapped of all the crypto tokens instead of Bitcoin getting wrapped on all the other.
Oh, man. We would
the future of Bitcoin DEXs.
Yeah.
We would break Bitcoin Twitter if we had wrapped Ethereum on the Lightning Network.
So if anyone finds that super, like, they want wrapped Ethereum on Bitcoin just for fun and giggles, come contribute to Specs.
It'll happen. I guarantee you it's going to happen, even if it's just a meme.
Yeah. Someone will do it for the memes.
I'm sure we'll get like RGB or synthetic Dogecoin for sure. It's going to happen.
Oh, yeah. That'd be fun.
What about security tokens? So do you think there would ever be like a case for like an institution to launch sort of a token that represents shares on top of Bitcoin?
I don't see why not.
I'd have to ask a lawyer, to be honest.
I mean, like, legally it might be dicey, but I think eventually, like, I feel like it's a preferred system. I'd rather have, like, at least in my opinion, rather like hold a private key to my assets versus, you know, just trusting that Fidelity keeps my records correct.
Yeah.
So
I do know that a lot of Bitcoin and specifically Lightning gaming companies are at least somewhat interested in NFTs, non-fungible tokens on Lightning, where, you know, the actual kind of in-game stuff is, you know, transferable over the Lightning network. You know, you could make like in-game artwork or outfits or whatever, sell them.
Yeah, so for like a card game, like, I don't know, like Hearthstone or something, you could have like limited edition cards and make
And I think like
really scarce.
Yeah, and I think Light Knight, those guys were interested in kind of, you know, a Fortnite-ish model, but where rather than using like V-Bucks or whatever it is, using like Lightning sats with non-fungible tokens and stuff.
Yeah, so NFTs are kind of interesting to me. Like, I don't think they make a lot of sense. So hopefully you guys can clarify this a little bit. So like the reason that we trust Bitcoin is because it's only accessing like what's inside the Bitcoin network. And we can prove that the tokens are scarce. So whenever you, whenever you're sort of bringing in like the Oracle problem, like you're bringing in something from the outside into a blockchain network, you're sort of trusting that that represents something, like let's say an in-game asset or, you know, a piece of artwork, whatever it is, like that it's actually scarce in the real world. So
yeah,
like, I don't know, how does, how would that
yeah,
work?
So to be super clear, the NFTs we're talking about are not like an ER7 whatever the hell it is token. They are literally like, I don't know, proof of ownership, which is used to convince like the game server that you own a token. So in all of this, you know, you would be trusting the game server because you're playing the game. And, you know, you trust that when you pay for something, you get it, given that you have the proof that you paid for it and own the thing. So this is all kind of centralized off-chain activity, which is just being supported using things like RGB, which again, RGB doesn't really like do much in terms, especially on Lightning, do much in terms of like bloating data or anything like this that goes on chain. It's kind of just like using the cryptographic commitments that are already kind of built into anything you do with Bitcoin on chain to enable new use cases off chain. In this case, fully trusted use cases.
Yeah, and I think like to highlight, like, you know, it's like if you're doing like a game, at the end of the day, you're gonna have to trust the game developers because like most likely the game's not gonna be open source and it's not gonna be like peer to peer. They're gonna have like a centralized server. So whatever that server says is always gonna be, at the end of the day, like the truth in that game. So like you kind of have to trust them. So like doing a like a, you know, like a ERC721 token where it's like provably scarce is kind of like useless, just because, you know, the game server could inflate the supply and they're not going to care what the blockchain says. They're, right. The game's going to run what the server says. So like, doing these like RGB tokens kind of is nice, because then you could still do like this like transfer stuff without needing like a game server.
Yeah, and additionally you can have like a collaboration between a bunch of different games where they have kind of transferable between game NFTs and stuff like that. So like, you know, you could picture, you know, two different shooters. I know that
I heard a good example for this was like like Minecraft servers, maybe like you might be able to like transfer, you know, if I have like 1,000 diamonds in one server and want to take it to another, you could make like a token for that. And
totally, you know, it's kind of in the same way that people envision in the future that, like, you know, if you're integrating Lightning into your video games, you can have like your winnings from one game be transferred into deposits into another game. You know, it's kind of in exactly the same vein, you could do the same thing with Lightning enabled NFTs, so long as, you know, multiple game servers support whatever it is, like whatever cool outfit or artwork it is you built. You know, you want to move your like Sims artwork to, you know, I don't know, your Minecraft server or something.
Yeah. Interesting. So we've talked about a lot technically. We're coming up on an hour and a half right now. I do want to get you guys' opinion, because I seem to be disagreeing with a lot of what I've seen on Bitcoin Twitter about the
BitMEX Arthur Hayes incident. So what do you guys think about that?
Oh, well, then you must be wrong. No, I'm joking.
Hey, that's what it feels like. It's like, oh man, disagreed with the cult today. But yeah, so I mean, I personally don't think what BitMEX facilitated was good for Bitcoin. And yeah, I think it's absolutely wrong, like, for them to go after Arthur Hayes and like and the rest of sort of the founders and the team there, like legally, like, and you know, try to imprison them for things that the sort of legacy financial system does every day, orders of magnitude, like on a worse scale. So I think it's, you know, totally hypocritical, and they're trying to make an example. But I also don't think, you know, you should have basically like be able to short Bitcoin with 100x leverage and like no one knows who you are. So what do you guys think?
I mean, in my opinion, you should be able to gamble whatever you want, and you know, you'll pay the price for that. But I think it's, yeah, I agree. Like, it's pretty dumb that they're like going after him legally, and you know, like, I think it was like literally like a month ago they showed like how much money like that like all the like traditional banks were like laundering, and it was like orders of magnitude higher.
Yeah,
and then that, they get fined, and then they go after BitMEX, which is doing, you know, like way smaller volume and actually doing for like jail time and stuff like that, which is just kind of shows the two-tier justice system we have in this world. Kind of sucks.
I'm gonna pull out my uneducated card. I know nothing about finance that I didn't learn by working on DLCs, and I've been working on DLCs too much recently to be following, so I don't know what's going on very much, but yeah, what Ben said? Question mark.
Man, well, is there anything else that we missed? Anything else you guys want to talk about?
We already showed the blog posts and the spec. Also, check those out.
Yeah, I'll be sure to link people in the show notes.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. I don't know. Is there anything else you want to talk about? I'm trying to. I remember I tweeted out a long list of things that I claim to be comfortable talking about. Oh, yeah. We could talk about escrows. We could talk about cryptography. But we could also just, you know, leave those things out.
I think we hit some good topics.
Yeah. I think if we started talking about cryptography now, this could be another rabbit hole.
So yeah, time to start talking about post-quantum cryptography. I think we need deep dive. Let's go. No, I'm joking.
Definitely. Let's save that for another show, though. If you guys want to come back on, we can definitely. I'll be sure to just listen, because I'm not going to be able to contribute very much to that conversation. But
yeah,
awesome. Well,
hard to do without a whiteboard, too.
Maybe we'll get a Zoom call or something.
Okay, users, are you ready? We're over audio. Picture a 100 dimensional lattice.
All right, guys. Hey, really appreciate it. Be sure, I'll link everybody to Shirtbits, all your blog posts, you know, everything you guys are putting out. Doing great work. Appreciate you guys.
Awesome. Thank you. Thanks for having us.